kill among the living, I see. Well, you never know. You just never know. You just go along figuring some things don't change ever, like being able to drive on a public highway without somebody trying to murder you. And then one stupid thing happens. 20, 25 minutes out of your whole life. And all the ropes that kept you hanging in there get cut loose. And it's like there you are, right back in the jungle again. All right, boy, it was a nightmare, but it's over now. It's all over.
Episode 13 of Once Upon a Nightmare. I am your host Lorraine, and I'm here to discuss the horrors of the world, be it fictional or real. This week we are going fictional. I'm going to discuss a movie from the 70s, which I recently saw again and loved it. It is a great film, with spoilers of course. It's Duel. Duel was a breakout film for a very young Steven Spielberg in 1971. It was his directorial debut. It is an action thriller and it was made for TV at first. The film, when it was first released, was originally quite short, but Spielberg was to add an additional 20 minutes to make it just over an hour and a half, as it was originally only 74 minutes, so they upped it for the theatrical release. It was written by a Richard Matheson of the Twilight Zone fame. He has said the story come from a journey he took with a friend of his, that was Jerry Scholl, and they were making their way through Grimes Canyon. They said it was a terrifying journey as a truck tailgated them for quite some distance. Matheson said, "We were screaming out the windows with as much fury about Kennedy's assassination as about him trying to kill us. The men were really forced to career off the side of the road, fishtailing until Scholl finally rightened and stopped the car, and Matheson scribbled on the back of an envelope, 'Story idea, murderous truck chases man down rural highway.'" The story was then discovered by Steven Spielberg's secretary. Spielberg actually wanted the film to be a silent movie, which I could have seen, you know, that would have actually worked for a film like this, but the producers didn't want it. With the release of Jaws, later on, Spielberg did pioneer the way for the blockbuster film in the mid-70s, but with a film like Duel, it's just the simplicity of it that keeps it going to this day. Definitely still worth a watch and does hold well. And could this film have been like the start of a new craze, the craze of the remoteness of America? I've often spoken about the vast lands of America as like the perfect location for scary movies. And, you know, as you wonder, will anyone hear you scream when there's no one about and nowhere to be, no houses to be seen for miles? And this film does exactly that. The roads for most of it are empty, with just basically a car and this murderous truck for company. And then we have films such as like the 1972 Deliverance, The Hills Have Eyes back in 1977. And they too were films that were out in the middle of nowhere. And they take us out of our comfort zone, take us into the unknown, like that of Duel. The budget for Duel was around $450,000, and there was a schedule for it to be completed filming in about 10 days. This, of course, did not happen, and it ran over for about 3 days, so it ended up being about a 13-day shoot. And a lot would need to go into the shots to get the real full impact of what they wanted to do with this truck. They used certain techniques to get the high speed scenes, and they were made possible thanks to the 1968 film from Steve McQueen, Bullet. Spielberg borrowed a camera that was actually used during that film, and it was able to get lower to only 6 inches from the ground. So it gave us that view. Plus, he was lucky enough to have Carrie Loftin. He was a stunt coordinator, stunt driver, and you know, he actually did work on the 1968 movie as a stunt driver and a stunt coordinator, along with other films and TV shows such as The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the TV series, Star Trek, the TV series, French Connection, and then another of Spielberg's movies, The Sugarland Express. And I have to say, just a side note, you really have to check this guy out. He is so impressive with all the work he's done. Very impressive resume. I think well over 300 films. So for those of you who don't know about Jewel, first of all, go watch it, then come back. But if you want a little breakdown, it has quite a small cast. Dennis Weaver plays an electronic salesman, David Mann, and the unknown truck driver is played by, as mentioned, Carrie Loftin. And among a few others, there's a couple of diners, a few drivers. And I'm always pleasantly surprised when a film with a very small cast manages to, you know, really keep your attention. And this film really does that. Man is driving across country. The movie opens in downtown Los Angeles, where Man drives down South Broadway before heading on to Highway 5, the Golden State Freeway, towards Bakersfield. On this journey across a two-lane highway, he encounters a rather obnoxious driver of an old beat-up oil tanker driven by the unseen driver. It starts off with a bit of kind of irritation as Man's trying to overtake. This guy doesn't want to let him. And, you know, you think once he gets past, he's out his way, that'd be it done and dusted. But that's not really what we get with this. As the journey progresses, we see the unknown driver becoming a real irritation to Man, who is just really enjoying tormenting him. And this soon becomes a game of cat and mouse as the pursuit escalates to a real deadly level for one of them. Most of the film is in and around Canyon County and Acton in California. Many parts were filmed on the Sierra Highway, and a lot of the landmarks used are still there to this day. A cafe, which I'm going to talk about, is now a French restaurant called Le Chien, and it actually is still on the Sierra Highway. Before we go into it, though, I think we need to address why this film is on a horror podcast, because I know some will be listening or watching this thing and think to themselves, that is not horror. While I can see that it's not horror, maybe in the true sense of the world, we do get the same kind of feeling when we're wondering, is a killer going to jump out and kill us at any given moment? A person's being chased, hunted, if you will, and there's a weapon that can kill him, a monstrous truck. I mean, it's actually rated a 15, but to be honest, when I was like 15, to watch this, it wouldn't have even been on my radar. I would have been quite bored, because at 15, you know, especially over here, I know it's a bit different in America, but we don't really start driving until we're 17. And, you know, we don't know the pitfalls of the road like that of an adult and being out on the open road. And as a kid, you kind of sit in the back, you don't pay much attention. You might pipe up when you hear your parents shouting, asshole, to someone. But road rage is very much a thing and is alive and well with some serious outcomes. Like, people have actually been killed in fits of road rage, which is what this movie is. It's the ultimate road rage movie. The poster itself, if you look at it, is quite terrifying. I get we don't have all the blood and gore, but the psychological impact of this film is so much more. And that is how I personally prefer my horror films. I'm all about the psychological. The poster is rather unpleasant. It's this really gross off yellow, and we see this man screaming with a truck that's basically bursting through the bottom of his face. And it's also quite vague, as it mentions a killer truck. It says the killer weapon, a 40-ton truck, the victim's only defense, a startling trap. I mean, we have films like Christine, but that wasn't until 1983, and you think of a car as being a little bit more nippy, you can get away, but what can a truck do? You know, they can be quite slow, especially when going up hills and getting a start. Although I have been told that the ones in America, the lorries in America, are quite speedy. The killer, aka the truck, was a 1955 Peterbilt 281, the uncredited main actor, if you will, which did not survive the short shoot, the original film made for TV, as it does take a little bit of a tumble at the end. And after the success of the TV release, the studios obviously wanted to give it that theatrical release, make more money. And they felt that the TV film was too short, which, to be honest with you, I don't think I've ever seen a film that short at the cinema. So they added some extra scenes. Those scenes were the school bus, the railway track, and the call that Man makes to his wife. As the original truck was, of course, destroyed in the original, they needed a new one. So they brought two more trucks, one of which is actually still in existence today. It was a 1961 Peterbilt 351, owned by a truck collector called Brad Wicks. And apparently that truck still runs today. There was actually a casting call for a truck, if you can believe me. The truck is the antagonist of the movie, so it really needed to literally play the part of a murderer. So Spielberg decided to audition the truck like that he would have cast in a part for a person. Apparently, 7 trucks were auditioned for the role, so 6 had to be told they didn't get it. The truck does have lots of personality and is very menacing. It's so beat up looking and just a bundle of rust, but it manages to keep up with man who is driving a 1970 Plymouth Valiant with a 318 V8 engine. Now, I personally don't know what any of that means, but I assume that this car could outrun a rusty old truck. They also use a 1971 Valiant with a 225 slant 6. Basically, they used a red car that looked fast. The car had to be red so it could be seen in the distance when it's, you know, to stand out with the wide shots that they used that took place on the desert highway. But as you can probably tell, I know nothing about cars. I was hoping it sounded like I did, but I do not. The importance of the truck is evident as we rely on it for the scare. As the driver is unknown, we do not know his reasoning. We cannot talk to him. We never hear his voice. We never see an expression. The truck has to give us all that as it roars up behind man. I found myself at times shouting at the screen. Why doesn't man just put his foot down? How can he not get away? I have the frustration not only for what is happening to man, but also how he's reacting. Now, I know this is a thing with horror films. You know, we've got it all figured out. You know, we wouldn't run up the stairs away from the boogeyman. We'd head out the door into the arm of safety. But when we watch horror films, they're full of moments where we think, what are you doing? And I feel that way with Jewel quite a lot. While you're on man's side, he does also drive you nuts. And that is because how he is reacting. Man, though, pretty much throughout the whole film, not all of it, but pretty much all of it, he's a bit of a weak character, and that's until the end. The film severely attacks his masculine side. The conversation with his wife on the phone about how one of his co-workers practically raped her, and he just stood by and did nothing. When he enters a diner full of men, it's obvious he's in need of help, but is met with like all this sniggering from the men who kind of look at him like he's quite pathetic. And all the men are sat at the bar eating burgers, and he's ordering a Swiss cheese sandwich with water. And, you know, as others, like, they're barely chewing their food and they're just shoving it in their mouth and washing it down with beer. You know, and then there's the whole scene with the school bus. He's trying to help the children, but they're taking no notice and they're mocking him. He kind of has no authority over anyone. Like, everyone just kind of like dismisses him really easily. And now the truck is constantly getting the better of him when you feel like he should just be able to outrun him. There is one particular scene though that I really feel needs to be pointed out about what this truck is doing to him. And this gets your attention. And this scene is terrifying. And it's when he stops at the gas station, which is called Snakerama. And it's kind of scary for a few reasons. Firstly, we have man who is frantically trying to call the police from this telephone box. Side note, you can see Spielberg in the reflection. Apparently there's quite a few scenes in this film with Spielberg popping up. But anyway, so he's on the phone calling the police, and the truck, I mean, it's coming for him, but he manages to jump out of the phone box just in time, and the truck plows through that. Then he just starts plowing through everything. He's like smashing tanks which are filled with snakes and massive spiders, which man is thrown into. And the scene is so manic. And at this stage, it would appear that driver is just after man. But when he does this, it shows he'll go to any length to get what he actually wants. And that's just to destroy, you know, man. The shots of the truck, you know, it make it seem almost larger than it is as we get all these angles and the sun's beating up and he's, you know, the shots underneath it. And we get views of the tires and the speed it can take and the sharp turns. You know, you can see how much this guy means business. It just keeps going around and around in circles as it's trying to kill him. And then, you know, eventually man does manage to jump in his car and flee. And the truck is just right behind him. And I'll be honest with you, this scene screams horror. There are, of course, moments when we come near to finding out who this mysterious truck driver is. When man stops off at Chuck's cafe, he goes into the bathroom, and when he gets out, the truck is now parked outside, and he is unsure as to who the driver is and is he actually in the cafe. All the men are sat at the bar, and they're basically dressed the same: brown boots, jeans, a hat, and pretty much all the same build. So man looks around with suspicion to everyone, and he can't exactly pinpoint who the driver is. Plus, we hear this voiceover as he tries to make sense of what is happening and why. All the men are looking at Man one by one, and this makes him super paranoid. But this is a small town diner, and when someone new comes along, everyone's going to be staring. While he's sat thinking over what has happened, we see the truck blurred behind him, and this whole scene is quite intense. Like, we don't know, is this truck going to go for the cafe? And why doesn't he just ask, does anyone own the truck? He then sees a man leave, who gets into another truck. He then accuses another man, who then gets into another truck. But while this is happening, the actual truck drives off while he's sat in the cafe. He runs out to try and chase it. But this also could give you a false sense of security. Has the truck given up? And also on this truck, there are many different license plates from many different states on the bumper. So this kind of gives you the idea that he's done this before, that this is what he does. He goes from state to state killing people, and he takes those plates as like a trophy. It's a perfect villain, really, because it's harder. It would have been harder to track people back then compared to what it is now. While we don't know much about the truck driver, we also don't know that much about Man. We know his profession. We know he's had an argument with his wife. But we don't really know much more than that, you know? Spielberg does give us quite a good, you know, he does a good job of making us root for him. You may feel pity for him, and you may feel he's a bit of a wimp, but you do actually hope that he gets away. And despite some frustrations, we still manage to have a bit of a connection with him. During one scene where there's an issue with his radiator, we still push for him as he tries to make it up this hill. The car is slowing down, and we fear this is when the truck could actually strike, as he's catching up behind him. And when the film starts, we kind of see him as quite a subdued character as he takes on this faceless maniac. But as the film progresses, we see him take more control of himself, become more determined. This is a changing man, of course. The change in Man is, of course, saved until the end of the movie, and that is when he really steps up. The end scene does have quite an impact as we finally see Man defeat the truck. And Spielberg really wanted to draw this death out, and it is really slow. It takes its time. Man has managed to escape his car. He puts something on the accelerator, which makes it fly off, and the truck then goes for it, pushing the car over the cliff. But as a result, the truck goes over too. And as the truck flips, we see on the side it has a label that says flammable, and you're expecting it, you know, an explosion, but this never happens. We see it tumble to its death, and you know this truck is, it's not coming back. It doesn't need to explode. Spielberg, he had to fight for this scene. After the network saw the ending, they wanted a different ending, an ending where the truck explodes. And Spielberg wasn't having this. And luckily for him, producer George Eckstein, he didn't want this either. He wanted Spielberg's ending, and he fought the network for him. And Spielberg said that if they wanted it changed, that they would have to get another director. He wanted the long, painful death, and he wanted the audience to have the resolution. And luckily, he got his way. Having said that, there was an unintentional consequence to the truck falling off the cliff. You may notice that the door is open while going over, and this is because the stunt driver of the truck left it until the last moment to jump out before it fell. There was supposed to be a piece of equipment that was designed to let the truck drive without the driver, but it didn't work that way on the day of shooting, and rather than wait, the driver did it then and there, as he wasn't available to do it again the next day. So there's only one chance at this scene, and that is the scene you get, one take, and that had the door open, so it had to stay in. I'll be honest though, when I saw this door open, I thought that the driver was actually going to jump out and actually attack Man in person. I'm glad it didn't go that way, but that's how scary films usually go, one last scare. But I think if we had actually saw what the driver looked like at the end, that would have completely ruined the illusion, because the whole way through this, the killer was the truck. It wasn't the man. He just happened to be the one operating it, if you know what I mean. And that's kind of the way I look at it. But after the truck has gone over, we then see Weaver. He gives a little victory dance, a dance of excitement, where he's won against this larger beast. And little fun fact about the truck when it is falling to its death, it is actually the same sound that was used in Jaws when we see the carcass after Jaws is blown up fall to the bottom of the ocean. Spielberg said to the sound effects editor to find that death rattle of the truck because he wanted to use it for Jaws. So after the truck has gone, like I said, we just then see a very relieved Man. We see him sat looking at what has happened, and he's like throwing stones, and you can see he's exhausted, and the sun goes down and the credits begin to roll and it's finally all over. So that is my little take on Jewel, which I hope you like and would highly recommend you watch. But before I leave you, it's that time again, the time for my podcast promotion of the week. This week I'm going with a podcast I wouldn't have ordinarily gone for. This podcast, along with another one or two, has, it's kind of really shown me that I needed to open my mind up when it comes to what podcast I listen to. I tend to stick to true crime and horror, paranormal, and this is by far one of my go-tos. I really enjoy it, but I'm going to let the girl tell you herself, and that is the gorgeous Tamara from Tamara at the Break of Dawn.
Hey, y'all. Hey, it's your girl, Tamara Dawn, host of Tamara Till the Break of Dawn podcast. Now join me every Thursday on your favorite podcast platform and hop on my train of thought as I talk about the foolishness I'm going through and the ways I'm trying to grow. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Tamara_the_Dawn. Now every other letter is an A in Tamara, but make sure y'all check me out every Thursday on your favorite podcast platform.
And just one more thing, make sure you go find her on all the social medias and follow and like and rate and review and all that jazz. And I just like to say thank you for listening. Don't forget to rate and review on iTunes. I will be back next week with a serial killer for True Crime Tuesday. And you can find me on Instagram as Once Upon a Nightmare Podcast, Twitter and Letterboxd as A Nightmare Pod, Facebook and WordPress as Once Upon a Nightmare, and email as onceuponanightmarepod@gmail.com. And I will chat to you very soon. Thanks for listening. Bye.